Last day of TechEd, last session immediately before the party. Thank you for joining me for this last session. It's about cloud, of course, and it's about the IT pro. My name is Rainer Stropek, und ich bin nicht aus Amerika. As you might hear, I'm from Austria, from Europe, so I hope every one of you can understand me well. You know, before TechEd, as a speaker, you are thinking a lot about possible topics, and I thought, you might have heard a lot of deep technical content over the course of the last week. You might have heard about IaaS and PaaS and the new cloud features. And in the next 75 minutes, I would like to not go deep into one specific product, but I would like to ask the question, what could be the role of the IT pro in a world of software as a service, of platform as a service, of multi-tenancy and cloud computing in particular? Because if you look up the definition of an IT pro, for instance, in Wikipedia, you will read statements like an IT pro is responsible for installing applications, installing computer networks. An IT pro is responsible for managing complex IT systems and things like that. And to be honest, the cloud platform as a service is all about removing this task. It's all about moving these tasks to a cloud provider like Microsoft. And to make this even more clear, I would like to start with a demo. Who of you in the audience has already played with Windows Azure or has some kind of practical experience with this cloud? So some of you. For the others, it might be new. And for those of you who have already played with Windows Azure, you might have seen that. But I would like to remind you what this Azure is all about. And what I have here, as soon as the network will come up, is a virtual machine running in an Azure data center. And a virtual machine running in a data center in the Azure data center without an internet connection is not very funny. So let's see. That doesn't look promising. OK. Wait for another few seconds if it comes up. Otherwise, I will open it locally. Here it is. Here it is, just right in time. What you see here is a virtual machine running in an Azure data center with a tool that you as an IT pro might not be that familiar with Visual Studio. And just take a look at this XML file. If you develop a solution, if an ISV or developers, your colleagues, your developers are creating a software for Windows Azure, they are in reality modeling a rather complex infrastructure. What I've created here is a web farm. You see this here, this web role says we have a web server in the front. You see the size on this thing here. You see that we have some worker roles who do background processing and things like that. And you know what? It's not complex anymore to do router DNS programming and load balancer programming. It's just an XML file in platform as a service. This number here, instance count 2, means, hey, Azure, please create a web farm, configure a load balancer, configure a DNS server, and deploy my web application into this web farm. You want to enlarge this web farm? Well, you can just hit 4 here, and you have a web farm with 4 nodes. I've already deployed this application, so let's take a look at the Windows Azure portal here. I will start with using the old portal. You see here I have this web application, and it would be extremely simple. Now let's switch to the new portal because it's more beautiful. And it would be extremely simple to change this web farm on the fly. I can just hit scale here. You see, let's scale down. I can hit save. And Azure will do all the magic for me. It will configure the load balancer, configure the firewalls. It will start or stop servers for me. It will do all the necessary things. So if we think back, what is the job of the IT pro configuring networks and load balancers and setting up servers and managing all this stuff? Well, what is the IT role of the IT pro in a world where we have a platform that does this stuff all based on a very simple, small XML file? This is the topic that we will cover over the course of the next 70 minutes or so. Let's get back to the slides. In this picture, you see the typical configuration of an application that runs in Windows Azure. On the left-hand side, you have the clients, might be full clients, might be thin clients. You have a kind of web farms with web servers that are accessible from outside, maybe some worker roles to do the background processing, and in between you have this firewall and load balancer infrastructure, and on the right-hand side you have some kind of storage. I mean, you could set up this infrastructure in your local data center too, absolutely no problem, but it would take you a while. In Windows Azure, it's effectively an XML file. Let's simplify this structure a little bit. I mean, this is the typical scenario that we have in every application. We have some clients, we have some processing, and we have some storage in form of a SQL storage, SQL database, blob storage, whatever. And this word on the top, this multi-tenancy, means the following. If we use the cloud and we develop some software and multiple clients, multiple so-called tenants are going to use this software, they can install this application either on-premise or in the cloud. And we are speaking here about multi-instance single-tenant software, because every single tenant, imagine you are an ISV like my company. My company produces software. We could sell this software, and our customers could build their own infrastructure. Could be in the cloud, or could be local. But in my talk, I want to go one step further, because now that we have this great platform, Windows Azure, we could build so-called multi-instance, multi-tenant systems. And this is how a multi-instance, multi-tenant system works. On the left-hand side, of course, you have some clients. In the middle, you have processing. And on the right-hand side, you have storage. But if new tenants appear, you can serve them from a shared infrastructure. We are talking about a multi-tenant shared infrastructure. And the beauty of the cloud means that if new tenants appear, you can dynamically, elastically scale out or scale up your infrastructure by just modifying an XML file. If the tenants become less active, you can scale down, for instance, to save cost and to provide your service at a lower cost point for your end customers. And if it happens that some tenants cancel their subscription with your software as a service solution, you could also turn completely off the necessary parts, or you can scale down appropriately that your costs fit to the revenue. So the rest of the talk, I'm going to focus about the role of the IT pro in a world of cloud computing, as you have seen it before, platform as a service, and multi-tenancy shared infrastructure. Because most ISVs today want to go to exactly this model. You want to have this shared infrastructure that is exactly right scaled for the correct number of tenants and for the right activity of these tenants. Of course, we cannot cover everything in this talk, so I'm going to concentrate on the last five pieces here. We are going to talk about scaling. What can an IT pro do for scaling, right scaling the infrastructure to run such multi-tenant infrastructures? We are talking about security and especially tenant separation and isolation. We will talk about backup and recovery, about availability and service level agreements, and last but not least, about the role of the IT pro in the area of rating and billing. So let's start with the first point, and the first point is scaling. If we take a look at this chart here, you see on the x-axis the time and on the y-axis the IT capacity. If you start a new service and you want to become the next Facebook or whatever, then you might project some expected load. You might think, hey, in a year or two or three, I might have a certain number of tenants, of clients out there. Well, it's sometimes hard to estimate, but let's say the estimate load is correct. Then you start with your resources. If you are not going into the cloud and you do it on-premise, you have to start with maybe one server. And this server costs a lot of money, especially the first server, because you have to buy the first rack, the first server, the first basic infrastructure of your data center, and then you can add resources and resources. But the problem is, this drives your cost, and it will not only drive your cost from a hardware perspective, but it will also drive cost from a software perspective, because you have to pay for licenses. And your users will not care about your infrastructure. They will use the system sometimes less than the resources could handle, and sometimes more than the resources are able to handle. And the problem is that we have sometimes a huge gap between the activity of your tenants and the number of your tenants, and on the other side, the cost. So what we would like to have is this. We would like to have the resources flexible, adapting to the number of tenants and to the activity of these tenants. Well, and as we know, this is theoretical, because you cannot go to Windows Azure and say, hey, I need 1 gigahertz more on this web server because I have one user more. In fact, we can scale up and scale down machines, virtual machines, servers. So this is the whole idea of scaling. And you know what? As an IT pro, it is your job to monitor the system and to care for the appropriate scaling. So let's take a look at a short example here. Let's go to my demo machine in the cloud again. And it's gone again. So we'll wait for a few seconds. We already know that it will come back. Any questions so far while we are waiting? The question is, the multi-tenancy infrastructure, is it per role or is it for the whole service? I will cover this topic in a few minutes. Okay, now we are back in the portal again. I will not close it anymore. So what we see here is scaling. You can do scaling in Windows Azure if you go for the platform as a service offer. Side note, this does not apply to the infrastructure as a service offer. So if you go for infrastructure as a service, persisted VM roles, you will not have the possibilities. Well, you will have some of the possibilities, but not in that beauty that I will show you here in a second. What I can do as an IT pro, and this is the most basic system, I can go manually to the portal and just change the slider, hit save, and Windows Azure will automatically provision new machines or remove some machines from your subscription. And you will pay exactly for the number of machines that you're using. Well, that's nice, but that's not really perfect. What you can do, and that's probably even more interesting for you as an IT pro, you can scale out automatically using PowerShell scripts. My slide deck contains a lot of hidden slides with hyperlinks to all the tools that I show you, to all the libraries that I show you. It contains also some hyperlinks to this Windows Azure PowerShell libraries. There is an old library which is published on CodePlex, and since last week, we have an officially supported PowerShell library by Microsoft, and these scripts are already adapted to the PowerShell scripts that came out last week. So you see, in fact, we have two commands to get the Azure role named TagAd 2012 Platform as a Service. Then we can get the instance count from this get Azure role. We can reduce it or add it, so we can add machines or remove machines again. And at the end, we call set Azure role. And with this, we are really doing a lot of things. We are deploying new Windows Server. We are deploying our software. We are reprogramming our load balancers. We are changing the whole DNS infrastructure just with two lines of of PowerShell script. And it's your job as an IT pro to think about, how can I use this stuff? For instance, if you know during night no one is interested in your web portal, well, you could schedule such a script and dynamically scale up and scale down as necessary. Question? Just ask the questions. If they don't fit to my presentation, I will tell you. I will talk about this in, I think, 20 seconds. Okay. So, you see, the PowerShell possibility is something that is quite simple to use. Another question?
Sorry, I was just going to ask, can you also change the VM size?
You can not directly change the VM size here. The VM size is your scaling unit. So you have to decide whether you start with rather small roles that you can add and remove on a very granular level, or you can start with rather large roles, which is kind of easier to manage. But if you add a new instance, you add a large instance. And this is a question of management versus cost optimization.
Uh-huh.
That's right. The question is concerning bandwidth, but if you add a second small role, you get more bandwidth too. You know, it really depends on the nature of the application. If it's a typical web application, a typical CRUD application that does some insert, select, update on a database level, it would really be a good idea to use a lot of small roles. If you are more CPU intensive, then it might be better to start up with a medium, large, or extra large role. It really depends. Okay, so we could run this script here. I can take it, I can copy it, I have my PowerShell console here. I can paste it. I can run it. And now if we wait for only a few seconds, yeah, it's running. So it's now updating our system. And we could take a look here at the cloud services. And in a few seconds, we might see here that our role changed to the transitioning state. It always takes a few seconds. It will. In a few seconds, we will see that our role changed to the transitioning state, that Azure reduced the number of instances dynamically on the fly. Okay. So let's get back to the presentation here. What about monitoring? Wouldn't it be nice if we could monitor our system and auto-scale somehow, add machines depending on the real load? Well, monitoring is, my experience, relatively easy if you monitor the overall health or overall load on your system. You could, for instance, use a component which is called Azure Diagnostics. I will not go into detail. Please take a look at the hidden slides for the hyperlink to Azure Diagnostics. You could use Azure Diagnostics and appropriate tools to gather data about the CPU utilization and things like that. You can also use a plugin for a System Center Operations Manager, or you could buy other third-party tools for monitoring. I have a few, in the hidden slides for you. It's much harder to monitor, for instance, the service level, the end-to-end performance per tenant. We are in a multi-tenant infrastructure, so we have multiple tenants working on a shared infrastructure, and maybe one tenant is very happy with the performance, but you might have a problem with another tenant because this tenant has, I don't know, untypical amount of data in his database and things like that. It's becoming much harder to do logging and scaling if you want to go to this area. You could do some application level logging, or you could buy third-party tools, and I would like to mention one here. The tool is called Dynatrace. It's from CompuWare. It's an application performance monitoring tool. And what Dynatrace can do, they can really do an end-to-end so-called pure path technology. So they can tell you, hey, we have this customer sitting on the other side of the world, and his real experience from click in the browser until display of the result back in the browser was so and so long, and you can analyze this. They even go one step further. They instrument your .NET code, and they can tell you this request from this customer in this true path resulted in a call in this .NET method, and it took so many CPU cycles, and it kicked off this and that SQL statement in your SQL Azure database server. So it gives you deep insight on a per-tenant level. It's really hard to build such an infrastructure by hand. You can, if you need this level of control for scaling, you can buy such a product like this Dynatrace product here. So let's wrap up this first part here. As an IT pro in the area of scaling, you really can influence your company's margin. It is not your job to set up Windows servers or set up database clusters and things like that. This can be done very easily by the platform as a service service in Windows Azure. You can also care for a great user experience, because now, if you know all my users are interested in the website, I don't know, at 2 p.m. on Monday afternoon because, I don't know, this is important for them, then you scale up maybe an hour before, and you scale down again maybe 2 hours later. For instance, I do some coaching and consulting work for various larger website providers, and one customer of mine, they know exactly that their peak load starts at 4 p.m. and lasts until 7 p.m. So they scale up at, let's say, 2 p.m., and they scale down at 9 p.m., which is very cost efficient, and on the other hand, provides a great user experience for the end user. Third-party tools can help you a lot. I mentioned some of them, and in the hidden slides, you'll see more about that. But be careful if you really implement auto-scaling, and for instance, do auto-scaling based on, let's say, the CPU utilization. You could. You could gather CPU utilization data and spin up new machines if the CPU has been busy more than 80% in per average over the last 5 minutes, or rules like that. But there is a new category of attacks, the so-called economic denial of service attacks. Because if you have such an auto-scaling enabled in your website, then a bad guy could come and send you a lot of traffic, valid from a denial of service perspective, but you will scale up or scale out, and this will mean you will pay more for the service provider. So if you think about auto-scaling, really think also about this economic denial of service attacks, and in my experience, in 90% of the time, scheduled scaling is sufficient. If you have to really go for auto-scaling, well, be prepared for some additional thinking. Next part, tenant separation and isolation. Tenant separation and isolation is especially important if you have this multi-tenancy infrastructure. So if you have a shared infrastructure, and you want to use the shared infrastructure to handle a lot of tenants. So the typical scenario is you have the shared infrastructure in the middle. You're on the left-hand side here, you have tenant one and tenant two. And on the right-hand side, you have some kind of database. Let's say you have a relational database in Windows Azure SQL database service. Tenant one, of course, is accessing his data, and tenant two is accessing his data all through the shared infrastructure. The worst thing that can happen if you run in a multi-tenant way is a cross-tenant access. This is an absolute catastrophe. If you are in a single-tenant environment, so if you produce software and you deploy the software per tenant in on-premise data centers, or every tenant runs its own Azure subscription, you don't have this problem, because Microsoft will protect them from cross-tenant access. But if you want to go for the multi-tenant way, this is a very important scenario that your developers and you as an IT pro have to care for, that it must not happen. sometimes it's not that easy, because sometimes it could happen that you have something like a caching service. Maybe you have heard over the course of this week that last week a completely reinvented caching mechanism appeared in Windows Azure, and you could use it, for instance, to cache some tenant-specific data, and tenant 2 accesses the database, again, through the caching infrastructure. But in this case, it wouldn't be enough to protect the data on a database level. It could happen that through the shared infrastructure, someone attacks the caching layer. So this is something that your developers have to care for. The question is, we as IT pros, what can we do to add an additional level of security in such a multi-tenant infrastructure in Windows Azure? And I would like to illustrate that with a bad example and a better example. The bad example, this is how you should not do it. What you could do, your developers maybe could store the connection string in the so-called web.config file. So this is an XML file where the connection string is stored. And you could decide that you store all your tenants' data in one single large database. On the right-hand side, you see this database. You have data, you have one column in every table, and in this table, you have a marker that says, hey, this row belongs to tenant 1, and this row belongs to tenant 2, and then you have a user table where you do the assignment. If user 1 appears on my website, I must only present him data from tenant 1, something like this. If you build this system, then user 1 could ask for a list of customer, and in the bad example, you are using one connection string for all tenants, and even worse, you use, for instance, a query based with a database admin user. User 3 does the same, and in this scenario, it would be a real catastrophe if your application contains a SQL. A SQL injection. Because in this case, I would be able to manipulate somehow, on the right-hand side you see it, the select statement, and I get a cross-tenant access. So as an IT pro, we have to critically think about the system architecture and think about what is the right level of sharing. In this case, we share the web servers and worker roles, and we share the entire database. And the question is this correct? So, as an architect, we have to be aware of the fact that the level of sharing does not only influence cost, but it also influences security. On the one end of the spectrum, we have the single-tenant infrastructure. Every tenant has its own subscription or own data center. On the other hand, we share everything. And the question is, what is the right level of sharing? In SQL Azure, for instance, you could say, I share tables. So, I put all my tenants' data in one common table, but you could use things like views. You could create views per tenant and add some kind of permission logic on these views. You could separate your tenants by schemas, by database schemas. You could separate your tenants by databases. In Windows Azure, it's extremely simple to set up new database clusters. I will present that in a second. Or any kind of combination of this solution. So, let's take a look at the better example, and then let's take a look at the SQL Azure practical demo. In the better example, you could say, hey, I separate the data of my tenants in different databases. In fact, in different database clusters, because as you might know, in Windows Azure, every database is under the hood a three-node failover cluster, and I will show you how you can create such clusters on the fly. You can have a kind of tenant dictionary where you say the data of tenant 1 is stored in this database and you could encrypt this data. Now, if a user asks for a certain list of customer in this example, you could take some kind of claims-based authentication. If you are not that aware with claims-based authentication and federated identity, take a look at the hidden slides. You will see hyperlinks to further readings in this area. You could take a claim of the user, decrypt the connection string, and then redirect this request to the appropriate database. This would really add additional security to your system. Your programmers don't need to change their code. It's really essentially the same code, but it adds additional security here. So, let's take a look at an example. So, What I have here is a database server, a SQL Azure server, running in the cloud. This is the old portal, and this is the new portal. Depends, whatever you like more. I'll stick with this one. And I'll show you how complex it is to create a new three-node failover cluster with database backup for disaster recovery set up. Everything's ready to use. I just hit Create Database, call it Tagged Life. For instance, create a business edition database. Hit OK. And with one mouse click, I've created a three-node failover cluster with backup set up. It's everything ready to go. That's, again, platform as a service. You might have heard about this infrastructure as a service offering that came last week. You can go for that. And for some purposes, this is perfect. But this is really platform as a service. You don't have to configure failovering and things like that. It's just there. It's done. And how do you access this database? I click here. I have my SQL Server Management Studio. Hit refresh. And you see, it's already there. It's quite simple to access. I can just hit New Query, and I could say Create Table, and I can work with this server just as if the server would stand beside me. But in reality, it's a real database cluster. So if you want to separate your tenants by database, you could, if a new tenant subscribed on the website, you could create a new database cluster just as I showed you. You could even go one step further and create a whole so-called logical server for this tenant. And this is, again, done by using PowerShell. Let's take a look at the PowerShell script here. The source code of the PowerShell is, of course, contained in the hidden slides in my slide deck. In the PowerShell, we see a little bit more. What do we see here? That we can create here a new SQL Azure server. We can create a new database admin and things like that. We can choose where the database server should appear. If you know that a certain tenant is based in this case, in Europe, you can create the database server in Europe. And if the tenant is based in the US, you could create the database server in the US. After you have set up the SQL Azure server, you can even add additional security by specifying IP-based firewall rules. This can be done with PowerShell, but it can also be done using the portal. Let's take a look at that. If I switch to the portal here, and I take this one. Sorry, I have to go to the servers, not to the databases. Let's take this server here. Then we can hit Configure. And on the Configure tab, we can interactively add new IP addresses and restrict the access to this logical server to specific tenants. And this should be clear what I mean with the right level of sharing is important for security. Because if you say, hey, my tenant is really, let's say, a large hospital, and I know their public IP addresses, then it would be a good idea to give this tenant or this group of tenants a whole their own logical server so that you're able to restrict the access based on IP firewall rules. And this can be done, as I show you here, using PowerShell scripts. The next thing, if you created the server successfully, as you can just create a database based on scripting. And you know what? This create database statement is all you need to create a whole database cluster, because as I told you, a database is always a database cluster in Windows Azure. So just fire a regular create database statement, and you are really creating a database cluster behind the scenes. So let's try this one. I copy this script, move to the PowerShell here, and paste it. Let's see. It's creating the server. It's creating the firewall rules. It's sending the create database statement. And now let's take a look at the portal. New one. Switch to SQL databases. Select the server that we have worked with. Switch to databases. And we don't see it. Check that. SQL Azure Server. seems to be a network issue again, because I don't see any database here. Well, I can go back to my good old friend SQL Server Management Studio. Nope. Run it again. Let's give it a second try. So, and switch to the portal. And I think now it's here again. Yeah, now we have two servers. Unfortunately, I ran it two times, but you see, it worked for this first time too. Now the network is back again. Here you see TechEd 2012. We created a whole new database cluster, and we interactively also defined all the necessary firewall rules. So this is the firewall rule, every one that I created in this PowerShell script. Of course, I could be more restrictive in this area. So this should demonstrate how easy it is to set up one database cluster or one logical server per tenant, and how important it is to select the right level of sharing per tenant. Question? The question is if it's possible to assign a certain web role for one tenant and dynamically run new web roles if a new tenant subscribes and things like that. Yes, that's definitely possible, and you can create such scenarios, again, using PowerShell script. So with PowerShell script, you can dynamically add not only new instances, but you can add completely new services or new roles to your Azure infrastructure. And you can configure the virtual networking infrastructure to, for instance, restrict access for a certain IP address. You want to run multiple web roles with the same IP. If you want to do that, you have to spin up multiple instances of the same role, and then they are behind the same load balancer. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. Tenant isolation is not only a question of the database, it's also, in non-trivial business application, a question of running code. Because in many situations, you have extensible or modular applications where, for instance, a tenant administrator could author some kind of script, upload this script, or some kind of module customization. Think of things like SharePoint, think of things like dynamic CRM. Such systems are able to handle such scripts, and then a user can trigger this script, for instance, a macro or things like that. In a single tenant environment, this is not really a problem, because tenant one, on the upper side, cannot execute the infrastructure of tenant two, two different data centers, two different subscriptions. In a shared infrastructure, this is really a problem, because uploading a script, uploading a module or things like that, and running this script could harm your data center, because everything runs in a shared environment. What you will need is some kind of sandboxing infrastructure so that the script can only run inside of this sandbox, and you can protect the other tenants from the consequences of this script. Your role as an IT pro is, again, to think about the right level of sharing. You could, for instance, set up an infrastructure like this. You have the shared infrastructure in the middle with web roles and worker roles set up. On the right-hand side, you could say every tenant gets his own database. And then you could use very small roles dedicated specifically to certain tenants, or you could also use the new Windows Azure website feature, spin up a new role or website per tenant, and use this as your level of sandboxing if you want. So again, it's a question of what is the right level of sharing? Do I share everything, or do I specifically assign some parts of my infrastructure to a single tenant? So what is the takeaway here? As an IT pro, we have to think about, in the area of data store, we have to think about the level of sharing. And this influences also the next topic that we'll cover in a few minutes, backup and restore, but we'll cover that later. You have to protect user and tenant assignments. In my experience, a lot of developers and also a lot of IT admins care for, they know that they have to protect, for instance, passwords and things like that. But if you store all your tenants' data in a single database, you have to really protect the user-tenant assignment appropriately, because otherwise, if I can't change, manipulate this somehow, I can get my fingers on someone else's data, and this must not happen. And of course, you have to protect your connection strings. Next topic, third topic, backup and recovery. Backup and recovery might be something where you think, well, why do I have to care? Windows Azure is a high available system, and Microsoft is responsible for dealing with catastrophes. So Azure protects us of a lot of things. The first thing, Azure protects us from any kind of hardware failure. So as an IT pro, if you run your application, your databases in the cloud, you don't have to think about things like, oh, my disk could crash. Windows Azure will care for that because, as I told you, every database is a database cluster. Windows Azure will also, Microsoft will also care for backups in case of catastrophic hardware failures or data center outages. They do backups, and they can use these backups to bring up your service again. Microsoft will protect you sometimes in the future in SQL Azure also from unwanted deletions and modifications. Today, this is not available, but Microsoft told us that there will be a so-called point-in-time restore feature with which you can tell the system, hey, give me the status of the database yesterday at 2 p.m., and you can restore the data, the historical data, sometimes back into the past. This is not available yet. So, as an IT pro, we have to care for, on top of the things that Microsoft Azure does already, we have to protect ourselves from unwanted deletions and modifications. And this can be done by copying databases or by using third-party tools, and I will demo that in a second. We also have to care for long-term backups. And this is something that a lot of people forget. Even if you will have this point-in-time restore feature sometime in the future, you can only go back a few days, not months or years. So if you have to, I don't know, archive your data for a certain amount of time because of, I don't know, some legal requirements or whatever, you have to create this archive yourself. And this can be done by backpacks or BCPs, and this is the content of my next demo. Before we do the demo, we have to speak about Windows Azure Storage. Who knows what Windows Azure Storage is? Blob store, table store? Not all of you. SQL Azure is the relational database, and Windows Azure Storage offers you, on the one hand, storage similar to a file server. This is called Windows Azure Blob Storage. And on the other hand, something that is called table storage. Table storage is a simplified version, let's put it this way, of SQL Azure, so-called NoSQL database, a not-only SQL database, with the difference that it's very fast, that it's very cheap, but it is by far not that powerful than SQL Azure from a programming perspective. You don't have stored procedures, no stored functions, no joins, only a single index and things like that. So it's very fast, it's very cheap, but it's not that powerful. So this is what Windows Azure Storage is all about. And this Windows Azure Storage is, of course, again, a storage cluster. So you don't have to care for things like, I don't know, disk crashes and things like that. You don't have to care for data center outages. Important thing, you should keep that in mind. If you store your data, for instance, in Windows Azure Blob Storage, your data would automatically be geo-replicated in a second data center in the same geographic region. You don't have to configure that. It's just there. Windows Azure Storage can protect you to a certain extent from unwanted deletions and modifications, if your developers have implemented it. So Windows Azure's Blob Storage offers you a possibility to create so-called snapshots. And in the future, you can revert to these snapshots. But you have to explicitly trigger such a snapshot to have it available. So this is an important feature, and if you want to use it, you can use it, but it has to be triggered on an application level. What we have to care for is very similar to SQL Azure. We have to protect ourselves from unwanted deletions and modifications, so we have to do some kind of archiving. And there are third-party tools, and as I've said, take a look at the hidden slides in my slide deck, and you will find some of these tools. So, again, let's take a look at a short example. What I have here is my management studio, and I have a database here, which is called TV Complete Sample, whatever this database contains. It is not really important. I want to create a backup of this database in Windows Azure. So what I could do is I could export this database. And I want to demonstrate how this works with a local version of one database here. What I could do in the cloud is I could export it to a so-called data tier application, so it's to a so-called DACPAC file. Who does not know what a DACPAC file is? Everyone know? Oh, okay. A DACPAC file is, in fact, a zip file that contains the structure of the database plus all the data that is in the database in the so-called JSON format, in a text format. You can create such a backpack file from a local database, for instance, tag add backpack. Let's do it this way. Hit finish. This is the local database. So I can already go here, say C temp sorted appropriately. And the backpack file is created. Here we have it. We can copy it. We can change it. And you see, it's in fact a zip file where we have, in XML format, the whole database structure and, in the subfolder, per table, the table content in a text format, in so-called JSON format. So this backpack file is a very efficient and easy to create way to create database archives. It's fully supported for SQL Server 2012, and you can also create backpack files for older versions of on-premise SQL servers. So backpacks are not only a way to archive your SQL Azure databases, but you could also create an on-premise backpack file and move it to Azure and import it there, or create a backpack file in the cloud, and if you need it months later, you can get this backpack file from there and import it locally to do something with this data, for instance. It's a very efficient way of transferring data. So let's go to Management Studio, and I'll show you how you can do that in the cloud. Of course, we could say right-click here, task export data to your application. But in this case, the database would be transferred to my local client, and I don't want that, because if that database is rather large, it wouldn't make sense to get all the data to my client, create the backpack file, and then where should I put the file? It would be perfect if I could put this file directly into Blob Storage, because this is highly available, geo-replicated in multiple data centers. They are at least 500 miles away from each other. They are in two different earthquake zones. So this data would be very well protected if we put it in Blob Storage. So why should we create the file locally and move it up to Blob Storage again? We have to pay for traffic and things like that. You can't do that in Windows Azure directly. Let's take this one here. If I go to the portal, and I take a look at my subscriptions. Oops, wrong one. Here we are. I have my, refresh it here. Here is my server, and here is my TV complete sample. I could hit export here, and I just have to enter the credentials for accessing the database. and the target, the so-called blob URI, let's say it is the path in blob storage where the file should appear. I could do that, but the problem is that this export mechanism is not transactionally consistent. So if someone writes to this database, you could have an inconsistent state of your database. So if you want to create a long-term archive in Windows Azure, you have to first create the transactionally consistent backup copy of your database, and this is quite easy to create. So what you can do is you can run one line of code. You can say, create, come on, database. Let's call it TV backup as copy of TV complete sample. This is the statement. And what we really do here, and this is the magic of platform as a service, we are duplicating a whole SQL Server cluster because we create a new database and therefore we get a new SQL Azure cluster. Run this one and let's take a look. The database is already there. Here it is, but it is not filled yet. If we go to the portal and we take a look at the databases, hit refresh here. And we have the backup here, and you see the status is copying. It will take a few seconds, maybe minutes, depending on the size of your database, until you have a transactionally consistent backup, and then it's quite simple to hit export and export this file as a backpack file directly in the cloud into blob storage. So the data is never transferred out of the Windows Azure data center, and therefore it's first fast, and second one very cost efficient because you don't have to care, you don't have to pay for the data transfer, for the bytes that leave the data center, for instance. So this export is a powerful tool, and in my slides, I edit some scripts here. I will not run them, it would take too long. You can also automate this stuff. So if you are an IT pro and you are responsible for managing your databases, it would be absolutely no problem to schedule this short script. It uses a tool, the DEC IE service client. In fact, this script triggers the export process that we just have seen in the portal manually. What you can do is you can, with the minus X and minus SX attribute here, you can also restrict the content of the database. Think of the following stuff here. If you have a multi-tenant infrastructure and you are storing data of multiple tenants in a single database, how do you do a per-tenant backup and restore? Microsoft Azure will not help you with that. They back up on a database level, okay? So if a tenant calls you and says, hey, I did something wrong, I don't know, fired delete from customer and I forgot the where clause, well, the database cluster took this statement and he said, okay, delete from customer, no where clause, I will delete all customers. And I will replicate this delete across the whole cluster, everything's fine, all customers are gone. Now, if this tenant calls you and says, hey, restore a backup, my data of yesterday, how do you get this data? And if you store multiple tenants in a single database, you can use this tool to create a restricted backup set by creating this XML file where it can add all the relevant tables, for instance, all the tables that are relevant for this tenant or all the schemas that are relevant for this tenant. We discussed that before, right, level of scaling and all this stuff. And then you can create a per-tenant backup or could do a per-tenant restore. Very important topic here. So what should you take away from this part of the presentation? First, you as an IT pro, you have to have a very good understanding about what Windows Azure protects you from out of the box. A lot is done by Microsoft, but not everything is done by Microsoft. You have to care for proper backup and recovery mechanisms that suits your needs, that fits to your service level agreements. If you, for instance, your end customer, you promise your end customers, I will care for maintaining the data back 2 or 3 years, you have to care for the appropriate export and import mechanisms. Okay. Third one, availability and service level agreements. I mean, every public cloud vendor like Microsoft, if you read the service level agreements, you will find a lot of nines there. You have an availability of 99.95%. But what does that really mean? Does that mean that you as an IT pro, you don't have to care for availability anymore? That's simply not true, because the problem with the SLAs is that the SLAs just promise you that if Microsoft will not meet the SLA, you will get some money back. The problem is that you are not compensated for the possible damage. If you, for instance, are in the B2C business and the Christmas time is your most important time of the year, and it happens that something happens with a Microsoft Azure data center during Christmas sales, and you cannot afford a downtime of even 1 hour, then you have to do something about it. Because if Microsoft don't meet the SLA, and that happens very seldomly, but it might happen, you will get back a few bucks, maybe, I don't know, 10%, 25% of your costs, but you will not be compensated. And therefore, we have to, as an IT pro, we have to think about what is the service level agreement of Windows Azure, and is it okay for me if Microsoft does not meet this goal, or do I have to build something on top to make my application even more available? And the thing is, the good thing is that in the cloud, even if you are in a small company, you have completely new possibilities to protect your data even further than just inside the data store. So think of a client on the left-hand side. What you could do, you could take your application and deploy your application in two different data centers, either both in the US, or you could deploy one in the US and one in Europe, or whatever you want to do. So you deploy the application in data center one, and if something bad happens to your application, to the hardware where your application runs, to the entire Windows Azure data center, you can configure a failover. And you do not need to implement any kind of individual hardware or software failover infrastructure. You can use the so-called Azure Traffic Manager, and I can demo that in a second. The Traffic Manager is not only capable of doing failovers in case of catastrophic errors, it can also do things like performance and round robin. Performance means find the nearest data center, nearest means nearest from a network perspective, to the end user and route him to this data center. Round robin, I mean, it's clear what round robin is. The problem, this is trivial, and you will see that in a second. It's a question of 5 mouse clicks, and you have this failover set up, and it works like a charm, and absolutely no problem. The problem is data. If you have your data in data center 1, for instance, in SQL Azure, the question is, if the whole data center goes down, what's with your data? Well, you fail over to data center 2, but the problem is your data isn't there. It's still in data center 1, which is down. So what I want to make clear here, Microsoft does a lot, but they can't do everything because they don't know your application. So what you have to, for instance, do, if you run SQL Azure, you have to care for proper data synchronization. SQL Azure does not support, currently, replication. But it supports a component which is called Data Sync, SQL Azure Data Sync. This is a no-code possibility to set up a synchronization between, for instance, 2 Azure data centers, or even more, the data center 2 could be your on-premise data center. So you can also, with SQL Azure Data Sync, sync data between your on-premise data center and the cloud. Such scenarios are possible there. Unfortunately, I don't have the time to dig deeper into SQL Azure Data Sync, but as I mentioned already, in the hidden slides, you have hyperlinks for further readings here. You could also transfer the data using regular backpacks, the export mechanism. You could export data in data center 1 every, let's say, hour, move the blob file from one data center to the other, and do an import there if necessary. For your blob storage and table storage data, you don't need to do anything because they are geo-replicated out of the box, and you don't have to care for that. Okay, let's take a look at Azure Traffic Manager. Let's set up a failover cluster. What I did here, Here it is. What I did here is I have created a small application. It's not very large. It consists of two websites. You see here, Europe North and North Central. Let's run this one here, click on it, and it just says, welcome to North Central US. So it's just a Hello World application. But I have deployed it to North US and to Europe. So I click here on Europe and run this one, and it happens that the data center in Europe is down. Well, I simulated that the data center in Europe is down by just RDPing into this virtual machine here, and as you might see, I've just turned off the World Wide Web publishing service there. So the application is not there. Imagine the data center has gone down. So in the virtual networking piece, what you see here is you can set up such rules. I open this one, and these rules say, hey, create a failover cluster from Europe to North Central US. So the primary site in this case is Europe. And if on the HTTP protocol, port 80, the root directory does not answer from that node, then do a failover to North Central US. You could add more and more and more deployments of your application to this failover cluster. And this is really a failover cluster failing over from data center to data center. So it's really a question of a few mouse clicks. And again, you don't have to do this manually. You can also, let's see, here it is. You can also use a PowerShell script. This is it. You can also use a PowerShell script to dynamically create traffic manager profiles. For instance, if you want to scale, now forget about failovering, think of performance optimization. You could say, well, during the day, I deploy my application to a third and fourth and fifth data center, change my performance policies, and during night, when no one is interested, I could scale down or remove deployments and things like that. It's all about scaling, not scaling on a per server base. In this case, we are really scaling across data centers. This could be accomplished by running such PowerShell scripts on the fly. Okay, so let's test this one. In this case, we are degraded and Europe North is down. So if I hit the URI here, you see tech at 2012 traffic manager. If I add this here and run it, you see, we are in North Central US. Although the primary node is Europe, we have been failed over to the North US data center. And we could check that one by taking a look at the DNS stuff here. If we take a look, if we do a DNS query here, what we see is that TECA 2012 traffic manager is redirected to North Central US, and we have a time to live here of remaining 30 seconds, and we could see, yeah, remaining 30 seconds, and so on. And now we will bring back Europe. So we'll go to the European data center, and the European data center just await. So our application is already there. You can take a look at it. We can try to go to the website that we had here, go to the hosted website here, Europe North. Let's see. Yeah, it's up again. So what we can do now, we can go to the DNS query and take a look. And you see, the DNS automatically changed from North US to Europe. And if I copy this URI here, this one, I start a new browser, go there, and we are in North Europe. So what I simulated just here is not a failover. I brought back my primary data center, and the Windows Azure Traffic Manager automatically routed me to the primary data center again. And finally, last step in my demo, let's go to the management portal, to the virtual networking stuff here. And you see, my cluster is on again. It's online. It's no longer degraded. Everything's fine. So what we have just created here with the cloud, with Windows Azure, is a failover data center facility that can be dynamically added if needed. And you don't have to pay for it for the whole year. It's your job as an IT pro to think about such things. If the Christmas sales is your most important time of the year, why not setting up a separate data center, a third, a fourth data center for Christmas sales, run this stuff in December, and the rest 11 months of the year, you don't have a failover data center, you don't have to pay for it. That's the beauty of the cloud. That is scaling on an application level with service level agreements that fits your needs. Okay. I didn't understand the question. Could you repeat that? Okay, the question is, how do you protect yourself from application level errors or from errors that appear from, for instance, Windows? Because in this case, all applications running on all Windows instances will go down all over the world. So if this is an issue for you, in fact, you have to run on multiple operating systems, not only on the Windows. If your question goes in this direction that you say, I don't want to receive Windows updates during a certain part in time of the year, for instance, that's easy. Because when you deploy your application to Windows Azure, you can tell Windows Azure, do not upgrade automatically. I want to say when to update the Windows operating system, for instance. And with this, if it's very critical, you could turn off this automatic update and turn it on later on. Does this answer your question? Okay. The question is, would this scenario not already been solved by the upgrade domains and things like that? The answer is no, because if we have a problematic knowledge base update, for instance, that kills my software, it would be installed on all upgrade domains, and therefore it will kill node by node by node. You know what I mean? Unfortunately, you can only, the question is, can you say, for instance, a certain upgrade domain is allowed to receive Windows updates and a certain upgrade domain is not allowed to receive Windows updates? That's not possible. You have to define the upgrade policy per role and service, but you cannot say this upgrade domain, no upgrades, this upgrade domain, receive upgrades. That's unfortunately not possible. Okay, last one, rating and billing. You might wonder, well, I'm an IT pro. What have I to do with rating and billing? If you are an ISV like we are, for instance, then you might offer this ISV, your ISV product, on a software as a service basis. So your end customers pay somehow per use. And this is where your role comes in. Because you might not only gather performance data for scaling and health monitoring, but you might use this data for rating and billing. You might use this data to create a usage-based bill at the end of the month and, for instance, to enforce quota limits and things like that. You might have a fair use policy. Remember, keep in your mind, you have a shared infrastructure. Shared infrastructure means that if tenant one pays a certain amount of money and tenant two pays the same amount of money, tenant one must not use an unfair large share of the shared infrastructure. So you have to enforce such usage limits. And this is the question where you have to think about monitoring for rating and billing purposes. How can you do that? It's common that for compute resources, you could, for instance, parse IIS logs. This is something that is often done by ISVs. You take the IIS logs, you analyze it, and you could ask your developers to put in some kind of tenant identification in every query string, in every HTTP request, in an HTTP header, or things like that. And then you parse the IIS logs, and then you could find out which tenant sent me how many requests. What you could also do, you could add some logging facilities in your application and monitor what does which tenant do. Of course, this requires a lot of programming, and therefore, it's rather hard to do. And again, you can buy third-party tools like the previously mentioned Dynatrace tools. This application performance management tools, they do that automatically, and I will show a screenshot in a second. If you want to bill or monitor fair use policies for your storage part, what you can do is in SQL Azure, you can use so-called dynamic management views. The dynamic management views can answer you questions like, how much storage does which tenant take? But again, the more you share, the harder it is to monitor. If you put all your tenants in a single database, in a single table, for instance, it's much harder to find out how much data does a certain tenant store compared to another tenant. If you just give every tenant a single database, that's much easier. If you go for Windows Azure Storage, there's a rather new component which is called Azure Storage Analytics. Again, my hidden slides contain hyperlinks to further readings. And you can turn on this Azure Storage Analytics, and you will see to a certain degree per tenant or in total of your system which requests have been fired, how many data is stored in Blob Store, in Table Store, and things like that. And you can monitor this or even bill this to your end customers. This is a screenshot from one of our development systems that we, for instance, create with the Dynatrace tools. On the left-hand side, you see, for instance, a chart that shows us the data in the SQL Azure database per tenant. We have a certain fair use policy. We can monitor that. And if a certain tenant goes over this fair use policy, we can trigger the appropriate workflows, processes, whatever. What third-party tools like Dynatrace are able to do, they can even go one step further because they instrument and they understand your .NET or Java or whatever code. They can even find out how many CPU cycles have been spent for a certain tenant because they understand the so-called true path. So they understand the request from the web client on the left-hand side, and they understand how this request flows to your web role, to your worker role, to your database, and they can instrument your code and tell you how many CPU cycles have been spent for which tenant. And for some businesses, I don't know if you are in such a business, it could be interesting to even charge based on CPU cycles. Why not? This could be a possible business model. And for this, my honest opinion, you need such tools. This is really hard to implement yourself. So, final demo, the Cloud Ninja metering block. The Cloud Ninja metering block is a component or let's say a reference architecture from Microsoft, and you can take a look at it and discuss it with your developers or download the Visual Studio solution if you are a developer yourself. What the Cloud Ninja metering block does is it takes some data, some log data, for instance, from the IIS, from storage, or you can even create custom data providers. It parses and collects this data, and it persists it in a so-called metering repository, in a kind of data warehouse, in a usage data warehouse. And what you get from the Cloud Ninja metering block, the hyperlink is again in my hidden slides, is a pre-built website. I could, for instance, take a look at the tenant level usage here. So you have some pre-built reports on this website. Let's take a few seconds. Come up. Here we have it. What we can do is we can, for instance, say what are the top 10 database tenants and how much data do they store in their databases. Let the data appear here. It still says loading. Give it a few more seconds. Here we are. You see, this is a typical standard report because this is an open source CodePlex project. You can, of course, extend it. You can also say what are tenant lists, for instance, and you can order this by database size, by storage, by bandwidth. Or, and this is the interesting part, you can use a so-called OData feed. who does not know what an OData feed is? Everyone? Okay, very good. So I can take this OData feed and, for instance, use Microsoft Excel Power Pivot to download my usage data and do some kinds of analysis, or even use this as the basis for my billing. So I can hit here from data feed, next, import the data, take only a few seconds, and here we are. And then we can, for instance, go and create, I don't know, we could create a pivot chart here, and we can say, hey, give me to me, I don't know, the tenant ID, and give me the value, and let's define a slicer here, and say, give me the blob bandwidth here, for instance, and remove this one, and remove the ... tenant here. And now you see, for instance, the blob bandwidth per tenant, and we could immediately, for instance, check what this is here, if this is a fair use, if this one exceeds our fair use policy. Okay. This was the final demo, so let's quickly sum up. As an IT pro, you have to care for scaling. Scaling because with this, you directly influence the operational cost. You have to care for backup, even so Microsoft already offers some level of backup in their databases and blob storage too. And you have to care for tenant separation. You have to think about what is the right level of scaling. Third, think about your service level agreements in terms of performance so that you provide a great user experience. Again, it's a question of scaling. And last but not least, you might become an integral part of the rating and billing process by gathering usage data and enabling pay per use for your software as a service solution. With this, I would like to say thank you for your attention. I know it has been a tough week, a lot of information, last session, last day. And the last thing that is up to me is to wish you a great party at the Universal Studios. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the night. Thank you. So if you have any questions, please feel free to see me here and ask.